Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Nicole Panter. She is a former punk rocker. She's a professor at the College of Santa Fe and Cal Arts and has some interesting stuff coming up over at the college. Right now, I would like to welcome Christine Barber. She's the author of the mystery, The Replacement Child, which is the winner of the Tony Hillerman Prize, and she will be signing books at Collected Works Bookstore on Wednesday of next week, October 15th at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you.
So this is your first novel, and I've talked to novelists before who have said their first novel is actually their seventh novel because they've got a number of novels in the closet. Is this actually your first book that
you've
written?
Yes, totally first. First one. I didn't have any in the closet, so to speak, before this.
How did you decide to write it?
I was in New Mexico for a while and just kind of fell in love with the place, and especially Santa Fe, and I kind of just started thinking, I kind of was getting a little bit bored at work. I was working as an editor at the New Mexican. And as much as I love my job.
Close your ears,
yes,
fellow newspaper people.
Yes, so sorry, New Mexican. As much as I loved my job, I still, wanted to try something different. And so I just started thinking about the history of the area and, like, different things that had happened at the newspaper and how I could make that into a mystery. So,
what was appealing to you about the mystery genre in particular?
I just love mysteries. I'm a total, like, mystery geek. Nancy Drew all the way, you know.
So from Nancy Drew on forward through, who were some of your favorites?
Nancy Drew, of course, and then Agatha Christie, Tony Hillerman, of course, all that kind of stuff. But when we were kids, we used to play this mystery game, which was my favorite game in the world. And me and a bunch of neighbor kids, my brothers and sisters, would make up mysteries for each other to solve. And it always involved, like, a matchbook being left somewhere to find as a clue. And unfortunately, like, a dollar we got covered in ketchup for fake blood and stuff. And you had to go solve the mystery.
Now, when you're making up a mystery game as a child, or when you're writing a mystery as an adult, I would think that one of the tricks is to have enough false leads.
Yes.
That they don't figure it out right away.
Yes, exactly. You have to have a ton of false leads. You have to have, not like you're trying to plan for them on purpose.
As a writer you are.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, you're trying to make it real. I was trying to make it realistic and say, if I was investigating this, what would be some of the logical things I would want to consider? And sometimes those logical things pan out, and sometimes they don't pan out, and majority of them don't pan out. And, you learn that as a reporter as well in journalism.
Now, were you a reporter as well?
I was a reporter in Gallup for several years, and I have a degree from the University of Florida in journalism.
So when you were a reporter, did you see cases or did you see stories that reminded you of mysteries?
Well, I filled in very few times for the cops reporter. But when I did, I always loved those stories, loved kind of figuring out the whodunit of it and trying to kind of, think of where the police who were investigating it, where their brains were going to go with this. So,
did you get to follow, what's the relationship like? I mean, this is something that comes up in your story, but between the police and the media?
The police and the media have a very strange relationship. In that, when you are the police reporter, the cops reporter, or in the newspaper business, you have to work with the police. But at the same time, you can never have that relationship be unprofessional. But it's really easy to become unprofessional because these are people you see all the time, and they're your friends, that you say hi to them.
And so what's the borderline? What does professional mean in that context?
Exactly. I mean, you get to a point where you have to ask yourself that question.
I'm really asking.
Okay. So I would think if you're going to have a personal relationship with them and start dating, you'd have to absolutely tell your editor about that. I think if you're going to go have coffee with the source, you would have to, the rules are you kind of buy your own coffee and they buy their coffee and you don't really treat each other. And you try to be really strict, but it's a gray area. You can really play around with that a lot. And I've seen a lot of people play around with that.
And one of your characters is always flirting with and flattering and gets a lot of what he wants that
way. Oh, yeah. And that's definitely one technique. It doesn't work for everybody. I think you have to be like a fairly kind of cute person. But it totally is a technique I've seen, and it's worked for a lot of people. So I personally have never done too much of it, but who knows? I still have career left in me. So you
started writing this book, and did you know that there was a, did you know you wanted to enter a prize contest, or you just did it for the fun of it?
Oh, God, no, not at all. I wrote the book back in 99. And I wrote the book, and it kind of, I got a really like agent, and I got everything going, and I was really excited, and it just didn't go anywhere. And so I decided, well, you know what, that was a dream. And I was actually really kind of crushed. I was like, you know, I just got really hopeless about the whole thing. I'm like, oh, I had this dream once that I might get published. It's too bad. It's not going to pan out. And then last year, a couple friends of mine here in town were like, you should enter the book. You should enter the book in the contest. And I was like, yeah, what, whatever, you know, okay, fine. Yeah, I have it. It's written. I'll just turn it in. And
so you didn't change anything?
Not really, no. I updated it because the technology 10 years ago or
well, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
Was a little bit different, but not too much, no. I just kind of put it in as was. I really faced it with the my dream was gone, the hope, all hope was lost kind of thing. And so I just kind of didn't even put too much effort into putting it in just because I was convinced that
well,
I was not gonna.
You tried once and it didn't pan out, so
yeah.
why should it
right.
work now?
I hope so. I got my hopes up so high the first time, and so actually I ended up leaving the country.
You went to Peru.
I went to Peru. I went to Guatemala and Peru as kind of the something to kind of just learn Spanish and learn more about some medical stuff. And I was in Peru. I hadn't told anybody from the contest where I was going because of course I'm not going to win. So why would I tell somebody that? But I found out when I was in Peru.
And somebody called
yes,
you in Peru.
Yes, the editor at the publishing company called the New Mexican where I had been working and where they figured out I had been working by doing their own little mini investigation. And one of my friends happened to be walking by just as he was calling and saying, hey, is Christine Barber there at all? And she's like, yeah, I know where she is. She's in Peru. I'm making the number. So that's
amazing.
How I found out. Yeah, it was really crazy.
So one of the prizes is that you get your book published.
Yes, I did, by St. Martin's Press.
Which is a very wonderful, well-known press.
Yes.
Do they then help you publicize the book?
Uh-huh, they do. They do, absolutely.
So if you're the winner of the Tony Hillerman Prize, what do you do now?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that part out. My hope would be that I would get another book, hopefully write another one. But at the moment, I'm just trying to enjoy having this moment of this thing that I thought was never going to happen.
So you worked in newspapers and you worked as an emergency medical technician.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So, and both of those, of course, you draw on in order to write the book.
Yes.
Start with what you know.
Yes.
And again, the emergency medical technician, that's heavy-duty work. You get to see a lot of, probably even more than a reporter, you get to see a
yes.
lot of blood and guts.
Yes, you do, absolutely. And I worked as an EMT here at Agua Fria Fire and Rescue in Santa Fe. And I was a volunteer, and as a volunteer, you get to see everything and do everything. And so I was did just the same thing that the paid guys did from the city. So
where are you from?
I'm originally from Wisconsin, and then Florida, and then here.
So what surprised you or struck you when you came to New Mexico and started doing the work you did, and to Santa Fe in particular?
Just that I had absolutely no clue about the history. I mean, I was just like, oh, Santa Fe, it's a Wild West town, you know? But I really had no concept that there was this, 400 years and more of history here and this, a whole amazing culture I knew nothing about. I was completely ignorant of it. Language, art, everything. And I just felt that it was such a great, amazing traditions, all the traditions here that are so different than where I grew up, that I wanted to kind of show people about them.
Were you hesitant about, when you write a book, you're having sort of an authoritative voice of
yeah.
knowing about these things, but you haven't been here that long.
Well, I lived in Santa Fe for 10 years, so you're right.
It's you did? Okay,
yeah,
that's a long time.
So 10 years is a while, and I also kind of tried to approach it with the reporter's mindset, which is research it, figure it out, make sure it's realistic, all that kind of stuff. So I worked really hard in incorporating very realistic stories from friends of mine who are from Santa Fe, into the characters, incorporating very realistic backgrounds, kind of what you would traditionally find here, and traditional people, people who are from here.
And all the same names that
yeah,
people have who
yes,
live here.
Yes, exactly, all the same names.
And so one of the things that you discovered about Santa Fe was that there are worlds in which everybody knows each other, but they don't necessarily talk about
yes.
what they know.
Yes, exactly. No, I mean, yeah, that was one of my funniest things I ever did was to go with a friend of mine who's from here at Fiesta and try to walk through the plaza. every single person she knew or she talked to, or, I mean, it was just crazy. It was, we couldn't go 5 feet without her saying hi to somebody, talking to somebody. And that's when it really struck me how different that was from where I grew up, because where I grew up, I mean, you ran into people occasionally, but you didn't know them all. And here, it was always, people were always like, oh, hi, how are you? And the person would turn around and be like, oh, did you know about this such and such, you know? So it's an interesting mix of everyone kind of stays in Santa Fe. And, you know, they grow up here, they kind of pretty much stay here. And it's really neat that they have all this family and tradition. So.
And then there's also another dark side, which is the drug side.
Yes. The drug side, and then I wanted to again be realistic in the fact that there is a drug side and a gang problem here in Santa Fe, as there are in a lot of cities, and I think Northern New Mexico in particular has struggled with heroin addiction and heroin problems among people, and I didn't want to ignore that. I mean, that's a, you know, it's a definitely part of it. So I wanted to not just, you know, to the happy glowing stuff, but also just give a realistic picture of what life here is like.
We're talking to Christine Barber about her first novel, The Replacement Child, winner of the Tony Hillerman Prize. How did you create your heroine? I'm sure she's part you, but...
Well, her name's Lucy Nuro, and she is part me, but I want to point out that she's kind of a... People have described her as like an alcoholic, as like a free spirit, as other bad words. But she's only partially me.
Well, I like
me.
The fact that she's sexually right out there.
She is. She's kind of a slut. I mean, she just, you know, she's gonna...
But, you know, it's like, if we stop using words like that,
yes,
what we have is what you might call realism.
Yes, exactly. And so I tried to present somebody who was a woman in her late 20s who had just moved to Santa Fe and kind of what her experiences were. So, yes, she has, I think, some aspects of me, but she definitely has more of the party aspects of friends of mine, who are still friends of mine now, who back in the day before they had got married and had kids, we used to go all party together and go to the cowgirl and get drunk and do all that kind of crazy stuff. You know, not that I'm doing that much anymore, but back in the day.
Now, when your friends who maybe a character like this draws on read the book, do they recognize themselves?
Oh, yeah, I've told them all that the one, there's... The main character, Lucy, she's actually drawn from two friends of mine. And one of them is Kristen Davenport, who is a reporter, and she's a freelance reporter. People might know her name. And another is a friend of mine from college. And just kind of like they're back when Kristen, before she was married and had kids, used to party. We used to, you know, go out and have a good time. And so, yeah, she knows perfectly well. It's all about her.
So the part of mystery writing, or the part of literature that's not like life, is that you basically get into a very complex plot and then everything gets tied up and all the loose ends are tied up.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I think that's kind of one of the reasons I like it, because you get to have this like nice thing at the end. I mean, you know, the mystery, unlike some other genres, it's kind of pretty straightforward in a way. You got a person pretty much usually dead. By the end of it, you figure out who killed them. That's pretty much it.
And there's often a second death.
Yes. Yes, and I think that the second death can add a lot to it. That's what I did in this one, there ended up being a second death as well, just because I kind of wanted to see how those two things would play against each other, and just kind of see how the characters would respond to different, you know, people dropping like flies. I don't know.
Well, I'm purposely not giving away any of the plot details, because people can read the book, which is The Replacement Child. One of the characters who's drawn from life is somebody named Scanner Lady.
Yeah, Scanner Lady is a real person, so Scanner Lady, if you're listening, thank you.
And she's still with us on the planet.
I'm not sure. Scanner Lady was, when I worked at the New Mexican as a night editor, she would call in with tips that she heard in the police scanner.
Can anybody just get a police scanner?
Yeah, you can get them at Radio Shack. And so she would just call in with the tips, and she never wanted to talk to me because I was a girl. She always wanted to talk to the male editors. And we never knew her real name. She didn't tell anybody her real name. I would try all kinds of tricks to get us to tell, you know, where do you live, you know? And, oh, what are you up to? And, oh, do I hear a dog in the background, you know? She never would reveal anything about her, about her life, about anything. And so pretty much I never knew who she was, and she stopped calling several years ago, so I'm not sure what happened to her. But if you're out there, Scanner Lady, thank you. Because I kind of started thinking, I I was an EMT at the time, and I thought, what would happen if I ran into Scanner Lady, like, as an EMT? I totally know her voice. I could totally recognize her. I talk to her all the time. But I had knew nothing about her. I was like, that is really intriguing. Because, I mean, this is Santa Fe. You run into people like that all the time. So I just started, that's kind of where the idea of the book came from. It's like, what if I ran into her in real life? You know, what would I say to her? You know, I like know this kind of strange little hobby she has, you know. So that's how the whole thing kind of got started too.
With the real Scanner Lady in real life, did she, because she was listening to the police scanner all the time and then calling you with stuff that she thought was interesting, did some of her tips actually make it into the paper as stories?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And it wouldn't have happened without her?
Oh yeah. There was one case where a house had exploded, I think over close to downtown, and no one was in the house, but we were scrambling at the newspaper to try to figure out what had happened. And the cops weren't telling us anything, and we were trying to figure it out. We're working all of our sources. And then she calls in, and she goes, oh, yeah, I heard two police officers say that the house blew up because it was a meth lab, which no one was saying. And so we're like, okay. So we had the reporter go say, hey, by the way, was that house a meth lab? And the police just said, oh, yeah, it was. And we were able to get that information. We wouldn't have been able to get it before because we were able to kind of come from this place of knowledge because of her. So
as in a newspaper, you also have a police scanner.
Yes, we have two. We had two at the New Mexican. I'm not sure what they have right now. But we had two. One at right at where the editors sit, and then one in photo. And you listen to them constantly.
So why is it that Scanner Lady got stuff that you didn't?
It depends what channels you're circling through. So the scanner will cycle through channels, and it'll stop. So it'll stop in the fire channel for a little while, as long as someone's talking. And then it'll cycle and it'll stop on the next channel where someone's talking. Well, while it stopped on the channel I'm listening to, I'm listening to two police officers talk to each other, at her house, it might be stopped at the fire channel. And
right.
She hears something completely different.
And so in theory, if you had enough scanners and enough journalists at the paper, you'd hear everything.
Yes.
But of course,
yes.
Nobody has that kind of staffing.
Yes, exactly. The funny thing is that the fire department, it is just as much a hobby for people to listen to the scanner as it is at the newspapers. But they're listening because they're going to be like, oh, well, I just heard the cops do a chase down, you know, the bypass. That means we might have a car accident, or I just heard there was a car accident. We're going to be caught paged out soon. Let's head over to the station.
So it's not voyeuristic.
No, I mean it's
if you're novelist, I suppose.
Yes,
everything is.
I got to listen to Scanner all the time because as an EMT and at the newspaper, that's all I was doing. So,
so you are now planning to pursue a career in medicine.
Yeah, and I totally blame being an EMT on that. I back in '99, I just had this. Life of, you know, I wanted to do different things, and so I started writing the book, and I went and I thought, oh, I was always interested in medicine. The EMT class is only a couple months, I'll just take that. And so I took it for a couple months and got completely hooked. And so now I'm getting my second degree in biology at UNM, and I'm going to hopefully apply to medical school here within the next year or two.
And what about your budding writing career?
I completely believe that both can exist. I have no intention of giving up either one.
And will you keep going with the same heroine?
I hope so. I really hope to, yeah. I mean, I really kind of can see, you know, kind of where the heroine and the hero, who is a detective, kind of both kind of seeing where their lives go. Absolutely.
And I would think, like, for readers reading a book when it's done, you sort of miss them. I would think for writers it's way more so.
Yeah, you know, it's like you get to write outside of yourself. Because in journalism, you're objective, straight, you know, you got to kind of stay with that. And this is completely different because I get to write, like, I'm pretend like I'm somebody else. And so in the book, I actually kind of come from the point of view of different characters to capture that, you know, this is what this character would perceive as this and that kind of stuff. So it's kind of fun being other people.
How do you do that in terms of just the craft of the book? How do you switch from one character's point of view to another and alert the reader so that it's not confusing for the person reading the book?
I did the most simple thing possible. I just made breaks. I had the end of one section and someone's voice, and then the next section would be in somebody else's voice.
So each section is from that point of view,
uh-huh.
So it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Well, it's a wonderful read, and it's great to have all of these places. You've got the Rio Grande Gorge.
Yes.
You've got Santa Fe. You've got all these worlds that probably many of us see the surfaces of, but don't get to go inside.
Well, yeah, and that the Santuario de Chimayo actually plays a pretty big part in it, and I kind of wanted to approach it from someone who wasn't from Santa Fe, what would they think of the Santuario? And someone who wasn't Catholic, what would they think of the Santuario?
Right.
And so I kind of wanted to approach it from that aspect of, this is, you know, they would probably think that the Santuario is a little bit strange. With the holy dirt and all that. And so I kind of wanted to kind of explore that. So,
Christine Barber is author of the book The Replacement Child, which is the winner of the Tony Hillerman Prize. And the Tony Hillerman Conference is coming up. That's a conference for mystery writers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be for actually any writers as well, because a lot of the breakout sessions, the workshops are not just for mystery writers. It can be for almost anybody. And that is November 5th through 9th. And that's in Albuquerque, so very close by.
And if people want to find out more about that, they can go to wordharvest.com.
That's correct.
And Ann Hillerman and Jean Schaumburg,
yes,
who've been on the show a number of times, are in charge of that. And have you gone to any of those kinds of conferences?
I have gone to writing conferences for journalists, but never as a writer. So I'm really excited about going, because I will be at the conference. I'm very excited about going. So I think it'll be really fascinating.
Christine Barber, author of The Replacement Child, will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Wednesday, October 15th at 6 o'clock. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
And your book is available at Collected Works.
Yes, and it's also available online at like Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
And so shop locally if you can.
Yes.
Otherwise, shop online.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Nicole Panter. She is a professor at the College of Santa Fe and at Cal Arts in Valencia, California. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And you are putting together an exhibition called FTW/DYI, which stands for
DIY.
DIY, F the World, Do It Yourself. And it's opening at the College of Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, October 10th. At
4:45
in the evening.
Yes.
Not 5. This is such an interesting exhibition of work that started out as student work but went far beyond that. Tell us the story of the genesis of the work in this show.
Well, I was kind of a personality around town. I'd been involved in a lot of high-profile kind of underground projects.
In Los Angeles. High-profile underground. That's a funny...
Yes, but... I can't think of a better way to describe it.
And you were involved in the punk rock scene.
I was involved in the punk rock scene from 77 to 80. And then I became involved in the genesis of the Pee Wee Herman show and the first 3 years of it, which was as a live play that we did at the Roxy, which is a rock and roll club in L.A. And it was a huge hit. And I also worked in the movie business. I was working with writers, and because I'd been a writer and I'd had stuff that had appeared in some mainstream venues, and that was my day job, the movies, after Pee Wee stopped. And in my spare time, I was writing short stories, and I would. I had one job at a studio, which a big studio that I won't name, and they had the most fabulous, gigantic Xerox machine, and I would do layouts for little books.
Now, this was the early 90s?
This was the late 80s, early 90s, yeah. And I would lock myself in the Xerox room when I was supposed to be reading scripts, and I would make Xeroxes of my stuff and then make books. And I used to have to fight for the Xerox room with other factions who really loved that machine as well. So
Church flyer ladies
and weird cult ladies. And I convinced some local independent, L.A. independent bookstores like Book Soup and Chatterton's to take my little books, and they sold really well. And a guy who...
No, these were little books that were actually like stapled Xerox...
Short stories.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't have covers and real bindings and so
on. Not real ones, but arty ones.
Right.
And this guy who had a small press bought one and really liked it, and he offered to do a real book for me, and the real book got reviewed nationally. the real book on a small press got reviewed nationally, which was quite extraordinary, and it got really great reviews. And
that was personal, I guess it's what you would now call creative nonfiction?
That is what I would call it, is creative nonfiction. I had another name for it, but I forget what it was.
Yeah, because that's a fairly recent, that name I think is a fairly recent invention. I'm not sure how far back it goes.
It was maybe thrown around a little back then, but, you know, the big wink of it was that it was really autobiographical. That's what it was called, is autobiographical fiction.
Ah, right.
I was interviewed on Fresh Air, and it just so happened that that coincided with a professor who taught writing at CalArts, had an emergency leave, and I got a call at midnight a few days after the Fresh Air thing ran, and it was the dean of the Critical Studies department asking if I might be interested in teaching a writing class to art students, and I thought about it for about half a second.
Calls you in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, yeah. It was like midnight. And I thought it was a joke. I thought it was like a friend or something being funny. And I thought about it. Once I realized it was a real person and it was not someone I knew, I jumped on it. And then I had to do it. And I put together this class based on the path that I had taken to writing, which was doing it myself, which was based in the punk rock ethos. During punk rock, I had a record company that put out a couple of 45s. For those of you who don't know, they were little records.
Little vinyl records with big holes in the middle.
Yes. And, you know, we did our own publishing, bands. Most every band that started very publicly. You would get up there and you could see people working out the fingering on the bass very slowly, and sometimes people would break things to distract from the fact that they couldn't play their instruments. So it was all like beautifully chaotic. And I thought that my students would really appreciate this approach. Well, I walked in the classroom the first day, and CalArts was a very famous art school, and it's was a very freewheeling place. It still is, but not in the same way it was 15 years ago when this all happened. And I was really excited and really nervous. Teachers had kind of saved my life at several critical junctures when I was younger. So it was, to me, a holy charge, this idea of being a teacher. And I was really afraid and excited at the same time, and I like totally went in the bathroom and threw up like big time before the class, and I got in there.
It was
and
just stage fright. Is that so funny?
Totally.
You, the punk rocker, having stage fright in front of a group of students.
Well, because for the first time in my life, it was something that, in a way, was a serious enterprise. I took my responsibilities in this arena very seriously. And I walked in this classroom, and what was supposed to be, I thought, a little tiny workshop with 12 people, and I opened the door, and there were 60 people in there. And I went through my spiel. I had organized this idea of a class I wanted to have. And at the end, I said, okay, does anybody have any questions? And there was, like, nothing for a second, and then a little hand goes up in the back, and it was some kid. And I called on him, and I said, okay, what's your question? And he said, what was Darby Crash really like? And Darby Crash was the lead singer of the band, the infamous band I had managed. And, you know, this was like 12 years later. These kids were 6 years old, and it shocked me that they even knew who he was. But then I realized, like, why there were 60 people there, because they all were big fans of L.A. punk rock. And I said, well, how about this? How about if you guys do this work for me, then we can also talk about punk rock. And it became a really exciting atmosphere. And I had to kind of put a limit on the class because it was a writing workshop, but it was like a huge limit, like 30 people. And the format of the class was that people would go out and write fictionalized autobiographical short stories.
And now, these were art students.
These were art students.
Drawing,
these were visual,
painting, video.
Drawing, painting, dancing. I had, at one point, the entire dance department in my class. because there was at that point no writing program in at CalArts. You couldn't get a degree in it at that point. And it was a visual arts school, but it was also one that was fully accredited, is one that is fully accredited. So students had to do a core of critical studies / liberal arts. And this was there was a creative writing requirement because they wanted, rightfully so, for the students to have this bedrock of critical thinking available to them so that their art would be well-rounded. So people, I would assign people the next week, maybe 12 of them, it's your turn to read, and they would bring stuff in and we would sit in a giant circle and all listen to it and talk about what made the writing work and how it didn't work. And the end of the semester, we did a few sort of collective zines during the semester, but the big project was at the end of the semester you had to turn in a 30-page booklet or narrative artifact of some sort. And being that they were visual artists, a lot of these, and this was the other thing that was really cool about the class, was that they had to do enough copies for everyone in the class, plus me. So at the last day of class, everybody ended up with like a stack of 30 books. And it was a really fabulous, juicy cultural exchange. And there were all kinds of kids in there. I mean, my theory about a good art school is that, especially CalArts, it occurred to me that every town across America basically sends their village weirdo to art school. And so I felt like I was home immediately.
Because you felt like that yourself.
Oh, all my life.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I know that's why young artists relate to me.
It's one thing to be the village weirdo or the black sheep of the family or whatever it is when you're 18 or even 25, but if you then, you know, grow up and go through your life and you still have that spirit and you haven't changed it to something else, that's a little more rare, and there you were for these kids.
Exactly. And many of them aspired to that, and I used to say that, you know, some of them didn't have visible talent, but they just knew they didn't fit. They wanted to live artistic lives, which is part and parcel of being an artist. And here I was, you're right, this adult at this point. I was 38 when I started teaching there. And it was a wonderful experience for me and for them. And my classes were so popular. My class was so popular that eventually became two classes. And then I proposed, I was still working in film, and I proposed to the film department at CalArts that I start teaching a screenwriting class, which incredibly they did not have. And that became
in California, of all places.
Well, but it was like an art school that kind of rejects the industry. But
right.
I'm not and never have been of the industry per se. I've always worked on stuff that has been great and interesting and fun. And eventually, I taught the FTW DIY for 9 years, and some students took it for their entire CalArts career. Some of the film students moved on to
you
my
got
screenwriting.
You were allowed to take it over and over?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very forgiving school that way, because they know that some of these kids are not as multifaceted as they could be, but it doesn't matter because the facet they have is so deep and true and good.
One example of that, which I had the privilege of seeing and which anyone who comes to the exhibition will have the privilege of seeing, was there were some people who just couldn't write, and so they did textiles. They made clothing, and now they're famous designers.
Yes, yes. They're Asha Minas and Marco Morante couldn't. They could write okay, they could paste up, but they really shone making clothes. And this wasn't even, there wasn't a fashion major there. They were art majors. And Marco is now a designer in Hollywood, and Asha works with Rick Owen in Paris. As she puts it, she's an in the smelly armpit of Parisian fashion, loving it. And they made these three dresses for me that are just the most beautiful things. I wore one to a premiere once. It was really quite the deal.
And there they are as part of this narrative class.
And if you look at them, you can see that there's a narrative. I mean, my attitude about narrative is the most sound experimental work has an underlying narrative. And it carries over to all areas.
We're talking to Nicole Panter, and the exhibition which is coming up at the College of Santa Fe is FTWDIY, F the World, Do It Yourself, and it's opening tomorrow at the Move-In Gallery. Which is in the same building as the Screen, which a lot of people have been to the movies at the Screen on the College of Santa Fe campus.
If you just go to the Screen, they'll direct you to the gallery. And there's going to be live music. Greg Turner, who's a colleague of mine from early punk and is also, oddly enough, a professor, college professor, is here in Santa Fe, and he's going to entertain us. And Paul Collins, a student of mine who was in Beirut, who's a fabulously talented kid, is going to do a short set as well, and there's going to be food and vino and lots of interesting things to look at.
It must be, I mean, it's quite a privilege for you to see these very young, kind of unformed, super talented people. I mean, there are some books in this show that these young people put together that are just the highest quality visual art. There's some caricatures, there's some artists, not even to mention the quality of the writing.
I knew I was on to something, like, immediately. I knew that Dick Hebdige asked if I wanted to teach this class, and I kind of, like, went away and thought about what kind of class would I like to take. I kind of knew the minute I formulated it that it would be a really great match with these kids and what they were doing, even though I actually didn't know them yet. I just had a feeling, because it appealed to me, and I was that kind of kid. And I think...
And that kind of kid means, I mean, not only the village weirdo, but people who've suffered.
People who've experienced stuff. Because you kind of can't hold on to it as suffering. You have to synthesize it, I think, as experiencing things. I had a really turbulent childhood. And I remember my number was in the phone book for years. And I remember, like, 15 years after punk was dead and gone, I got a call from a tiny little voice at 8 in the evening. And it was someone, a girl or a boy, I actually don't know, who had gotten my name out of the phone book and started asking me punk rock questions. And I said, "So, sweetheart, tell me about your life. What's it like? You tell me about your life." And she said, "Well, my mom is kind of crazy, and my dad left when I was 3. And it came to me in a blinding flash that people who have happy childhoods don't really become punk rockers. Whether you don't fit in with your peers or you have a turbulent home life, whatever. But those people were amazing. It was the most creative, free-thinking, amazing experience of my life, being in the middle of all that at a relatively young age. The age spread was kind of great. There were 14-year-old runaways from Riverside.
Are you talking about punk rock now, or the class?
Punk rock. Yeah. But punk rock formed the basis of, like, what... It gave me sort of a really great bedrock of how to give these young artists a system where they could actually make product. Because that is the hardest thing about being a young artist, is actually doing something from start to finish and having it be a viable thing. Rather, it seems to be a really big obstacle to actually complete something that you're sort of complete something that you really hold in your hands and go, this is a really great thing. And that's what I was able to help them do. Once you get past that hump, that's, like, I think the first big step to becoming an artist, is actually completing a project. You know, you think about it, and how many things does one have from that period that sort of half done, and you've put it away, and you're like, it's too daunting. So my job was to kind of encourage them to sort of do this thing under this deadline and complete this project. And with a lot of them, I saw just a giant step then towards what they really wanted to do after that. It was a really wonderful process that I've been able to keep working to help my screenwriting students. The work that has gone on in my classes for at least the last 12 years now, once I realized there were these big steps that they needed to be romanced through, kind of, or bullied through, depending on the student, that kind of a light goes on over their head, and the work just takes these giant steps towards adult work, from being student work to being adult work, and it's pretty cool.
There's the element of craftsmanship, and I love the aesthetic of these things. I think I have a personal, I don't know, just connection to them, because at that time I was just discovering Fact Sheet 5 and the whole zine scene, and my friends and I were making little Xerox weird things ourselves and ordering them from places before the internet really had become anything that was a vehicle for spreading art, or even before it existed.
Well, blogs have kind of replaced zines. The two things I think that really made zines, at least for me personally, fun were A, being able to set stuff in type via early computers, and B, Xeroxing. I mean, I just, had a love affair with a Xerox machine. You wouldn't believe. The Studio Xerox machine was, my favorite friend.
And it was really good. It wasn't blotchy. It had nice blacks and whites.
Yeah. It was like, I have a book now. And I think that, the precedent for it was mail art, which was a huge global thing in the 50s, 60s, I think 40s as well.
Which virtually almost doesn't exist now.
It doesn't exist.
It exists in postsecret.com, which if anybody who's listening hasn't seen that site, check it out, because that's an amazing thing. But it's almost gone.
And I think zines were sort of a natural outgrowth of that with the advent of the personal computer and the Xerox machine. And, there was a whole art to going to Kinko's if you didn't have the Studio Xerox machine, and, getting them, charming the Kinko's guy into not charging you. There was all kinds of things like that. But it, in a way, it was a really great intersection of handmade art and technology resulting in these books.
And then the other element is people's sometimes harrowing stories.
It shocked me it has continually shocked me to hear how many young women have been sexually assaulted. And, when you give people the little protection of writing a story as fiction, it's amazing what comes out, all kinds of sort of thoughtless brutality. I think, it sort of confirmed why I never wanted to have children, that childhood is a particularly brutal place.
No kidding.
And hearing people's stories really confirmed that for me. And I have students, former students from 15 years ago, some who've become my friends. Some who come back out of the blue and write me really beautiful letters about what the class meant to them and what I meant to them as a teacher. And
well, there's quite a bit of "you saved my life through this class" kind of reaction.
Yeah, and it kind of is. It's a really wonderful thing because it gives one a sense of purpose and accomplishment beyond sort of the narcissistic, The narcissistic production of one's own art. It really sort of becomes about service as well, but not in a sappy way.
Well, and art school and even art galleries sometimes have the reputation for being narcissistic and weird stuff for its own sake. And this is different from that. I mean, I've been reading some of the stories in this little book, and you can feel the depth and the importance for each person of getting these things out on paper and really crafting them into something that other people can read.
And also yes, that's absolutely true, and the idea that they could even speak this, literally speak this to the class, these stories, which some had never told anyone, some of the things that they'd written about. Disclosure is a really important thing with trauma, and so many people have been traumatized. It's just mind-boggling. And this is a step in sort of getting over that, is putting it out there and going, this happened to me, and declaring yourself. And it's kind of, it's a really profound thing to witness, and I never, ever forget that, even with my screenwriting students. It's yet another way to sort of work through for yourself. I mean, you know, that's what art is. It's sort of... Even the most obtuse art is trying to communicate something to somebody, or trying to work out something in a concrete way that you can then step back and examine.
And I think there's something particularly effective in terms of the person who's doing it, of making an artwork as opposed to just like saying it in group therapy.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because it gives it sort of another kind of concrete form that maybe does or doesn't stand on its own as a work of art. Because art is translating these things in your head into the real world, or the three-dimensional world.
So this is the accumulated work that you did with these students, that they did with you over the course of years.
The class ran for 9 years. I have thousands of these books. Some people kept on producing books after class, long after school. Some of them, I mean, I love it. I pick up the New York Times and I'll read one of their names in the arts section. It was just like a really great atmosphere. And you know, it wasn't sort of always, it wasn't a heavy kind of depressing atmosphere. It was like fun and light, and with an underlying seriousness. And we had great guests. One of the class's favorite guests was a friend of mine who is like the star of the continent now, a 7-foot tall black transvestite named Dr. Vaginal Davis.
Like, good heavens.
They loved him. Mr. Winkle, who was the star of Calendars and Books, who was this little dog, and the gal who put out the books found him, and she made a fortune self-publishing these calendars, and she had a career as...
Of Mr. Winkle the dog.
Mr. Winkle the dog, and she had a career as a serious photojournalist. My friend George Meyer, who wrote for almost the entire run of The Simpsons, who was like the head writer, he would loved coming to the class and talking to them, and of course, as you might guess, they loved him. So we had this fabulous range of guests who came to class and shared their experience, people who published books. I had a friend who has won a couple Grammys, a singer-songwriter. He would come to the class and talk to them. So we kind of, like, it spoke to everybody and all of their interests. And these documents really are amazing. They've been kind of away in boxes.
And you decided just to bring them out and show them.
Yeah.
And did you invite the students themselves who made them? Have you been...
Well, we put the word out on Facebook, and of course none of them are in New Mexico. Although some of them were from New Mexico. One of my students was Elisa Dressman, whose grandparents had the florist shop on the plaza for years and years. Another one is Isaiah Surrett, whose family is Surrett and Sons, the fabulous Indian architectural rug
downtown
place. Yeah.
And you're showing them, you've actually punched sort of grommets through the upper left corner. They're hanging from strings, and people can go in there into a fairly intimate space and read them.
Yes, and I invite people to come and read them. And we're going to have, I think, a table and some chairs set up as well, so that you can, with some loose ones that people can read as well. And it should be good. It should be, you know, I look at them and it's almost in a way, because of the handmade quality. Like, there are some that are 30 pages of, like, tiny, teeny, all handwriting, you know, with clip art and stuff. And it's almost like this fabulous kind of folk art project, but not really, because if you look at them at a sort of deeper level, they're not so unsophisticated and they're not untrained. These are trained artists.
So all of this is happening. It's opening tomorrow, Friday, October 10th at the Move-In Gallery at 4:45 in the afternoon. And you will be there, music, refreshments, and oh so much more.
Oh so much more, yes indeed. Music, refreshments, fun and reading. Please do come down.
Nicole Panter is a professor at the College of Santa Fe and at CalArts in Valencia, California. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, actually not live, recording at the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Robert Knott will be with us, and Peter Bull will be with us, the great dancer. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. And those of you who contributed to the fundraiser, thank you so much. Those of you who didn't, you can still do it at ksfr.org. Hit pledge now. We'll see you soon. Ciao.